Kurtz leaned back against the bole of the camel-thorn tree and carefully pressed shreds of crumbling dry shag into his clay pipe. His tobacco bag was made from the scrotum of a bull buffalo with a drawn string of sinew to close the mouth. It was less than half full, and he was rationing himself to his half-pipe a day. He lit it with a coal from the fire and coughed softly with pleasure as the first powerful inhalation filled his lungs. His troopers were spread out under the surrounding trees. Each man had picked his own spot to lay out his fur kaross. Their bellies were stuffed with the meat of the hartebeest, the first time in over a month that they had eaten their fill. So that they could better savour this feast, Kurtz had allowed an early halt to the day's march. There was almost an hour left of daylight. In the normal run of events, they would have camped only when the dusk obscured the wagon ruts they were following. From the corner of his eye, Kurtz picked up a flicker of movement, and he glanced around quickly, then relaxed again. It was only clear. Even as Kurtz watched him, he vanished into the darkening felt. A bushman, with every hand turned against him all his life, would never lie down to sleep until he had swept his back trail. Kurtz knew he would make a wide circle out across the ground that they had already travelled. If an enemy was following them, Clear would have cut his tracks. Kurtz smoked his pipe down to the last crumb, savouring every breath. Then, regretfully, he knocked out the ash. With a sigh, he settled down under his kaross and closed his eyes. He did not know how long he had slept, but he woke with a light touch on his cheek. As he started up, Clear made a soft clucking sound to calm him down. "What is it?" Instinctively Kurtz kept his voice low.
"Strangers," Clear replied. "They follow us." "Men?"
Kurtz's wits were still fuddled with sleep. Clear did not deign to answer such an inanity.
"Who? How many?"
Kurtz insisted as he sat up. Quickly, Clear twisted a spill of dried grass. Before he lit it, he held up a corner of Kurtz's kaross as a screen from watching eyes. Then he held the spill to the dying ash of the fire. He blew on the coals, and when the spill burst into flame, he screened it with the kaross and his own body. He held something in his free hand. Kurtz peered at it. It was a scrap of soiled white cloth.
"Ripped from a man's clothing by thorns," Clear told him.
Then he showed his next trophy, a single strand of black hair. Even Kurtz realized at once that it was human hair, but it was too black and coarse to have come from the head of a northern European, and it was too straight, free of kinks, to have come from the head of a bushman or an African tribesman.
"The rag comes from the long robe, such as Musulman wear. This hair from his head."
"Musulman?" Kurtz asked in surprise. And Clear clicked in assent. Kurtz had learned better than to argue.
"How many?"
"Four."
"Where are they now?"
"Lying close. They are watching us."
Clear let the burning spill drop and rubbed out the last sparks in the dust with the palm of his childlike hand.
"Where have they left their horses?" Kurtz asked. "If they had smelt ours, they would have whinnied." "No horses. They come on foot."
"Arabs on foot?
Then whoever they are, that is what they are after."
Kurtz pulled on his boots.
"They want our horses."
Careful to keep a low profile, he crawled to where Odoman was snoring softly and shook him. Once Odoman was fully awake, he grasped quickly what was happening and understood Kurtz's orders.
"No gunfire," Kurtz repeated. "In the dark there is too much risk of hitting the horses. Take them with cold steel."
Kurtz and Odoman crept to each of the troopers and whispered the orders. The men rolled out of their blankets and slipped singly down to the horse pickets. With drawn sabres they lay up among shrub and low brush. Kurtz placed himself on the southern perimeter furthest from the faint glow of the dying campfire. He lay flat against the earth, so that any man approaching the pickets would be silhouetted against the stars and the fading traces of the great comet, by now only an ethereal ghost in the western sky. Orion was no longer obliterated by its light. At this season of the year, he was standing on his head below the dazzle of the Milky Way. Kurtz covered his eyes to enhance his night vision. He listened with all his attention and opened his eyes only briefly so that they would not be tricked by the light. Time passed slowly. He measured it by the turning of the heavenly bodies. For any other man it might have been hard to keep his level of concentration screwed up to the main, but Kurtz was a warrior. He had to close his ears to the mundane sounds made by the horses as they shifted their weight or cropped a mouthful of grass. The last glimmer of the great comet was low on the western horizon before Kurtz heard the click of two pebbles striking together. Every nerve in his body snapped taut. A minute later, and much closer, there came the slither of a leather sandal on the soft earth. He kept his head low and saw a dark shape move against the stars. "He's closing in," he thought. "Let him start to work on the ropes." The intruder paused when he reached the head of the horse lines. Kurtz saw his head turn slowly as he listened. He wore a turban and his beard bushed and curled. After a long minute he stooped over the running line to which the head halters of the horses were secured by steel rings. Two of the animals jerked their heads free as the line slipped through the rings. As soon as Kurtz guessed that the intruder was absorbed in unravelling the next knot, he rose to his feet and moved towards him. But he lost sight of him as he crouched below the skyline. He was no longer where Kurtz expected him to be, and abruptly Kurtz stumbled up against him in the darkness. Kurtz shouted to warn his men. Then the two of them were struggling chest to chest, too close for Kurtz to use his blade. Kurtz realized at once that the man he was wrestling was a formidable adversary. He twisted like an eel in his grip, and he felt all hard muscle and sinew. Kurtz tried to knee his groin, but his kneecap was almost torn loose as it struck the hard, rubbery muscle of the man's thigh instead of the soft bunch of his genitals. In an instantaneous riposte, the man slammed the heel of his right hand up under Kurtz's jaw. His head snapped back, and it felt as though his neck was broken as he went over backwards and sprawled on the ground. He saw the intruder rearing over him and the glint of his blade as it went up high for the forehand cut to his head. Kurtz threw up his own sabre in an instinctive parry, and steel thrilled on steel as the blades met. The intruder broke off the attack and disappeared into the darkness. Kurtz crawled to his knees, still half stunned. There were shouts and the sound of blows from all around, and he heard both Odermann and Richter bellowing orders and encouragement to the others. Then there was the bang and flash of a pistol shot. That galvanized Kurtz. "Don't shoot, you fools! The horses! Have a care for the horses!" He pulled himself to his feet, and at that moment heard the clatter of shod hoofs behind him. He glanced around and saw the dark outline of a horseman bearing down upon him at full gallop. A sword glinted dully in the starlight, and Kurtz ducked. The blade hissed past his cheek, and he glimpsed the turbaned head and beard of the rider as he raced by. Wildly he looked about him. Nearby, the grey mare was a pale blob against the darker background. She was the fastest and strongest of the entire string. He sheathed his sword and checked the pistol in the holster at his hip as he ran to her. As soon as he was astride her back, he listened for the sound of hooves, turned her with his knees, and kicked her into a full gallop. Every few minutes during the next hours, he was forced to stop and listen for the fugitive's hoofbeats. Although the Arab often twisted and turned to throw off Kurtz's pursuit, he always headed back towards the north. An hour before dawn, Kurtz lost the sound of him altogether. Either he had turned again, or he had slowed his mount to a walk. North. He is set on north, he decided. He placed the great southern cross squarely over his shoulder, and rode into the north, keeping to a steady canter that would not burn up the mare. The dawn came up with startling rapidity. His horizon expanded as the darkness drew back, and his heart bounced as he made out the dark shape moving not a pistol shot ahead of him. He knew at once that it was not one of the larger species of antelope, for the shape of the rider upon its back was plain to see against the lightning felt. Kurtz pushed the mare harder and came up on him swiftly. The rider was not yet aware of him and was holding his horse to a walk. Kurtz recognized the bay gelding. A good, strong mount, almost a match for his mare. "Son of the great whore!" Kurtz laughed with triumph. "The bay has gone lame. No wonder he had to slow down." Even in this poor light it was plain to see that the gelding was favouring his off-four. He must have picked up a sharp stone or a thorn in the frog, and he was making heavy weather of it. Kurtz raced down upon them, and the fugitive swivelled round. Kurtz saw that he was a hawk-faced Arab, with a curling bush of beard. He took one quick look at Kurtz, then flogged the gelding into a laboured gallop. Kurtz was close enough to risk a pistol shot and tried to end it swiftly. He threw up his weapon and fired for the centre of the Arab's broad back. It must have been close, for the Arab ducked and shouted, "Swords, infidel, man to man!" As an ensign, Kurtz had spent years with the VOC army in the Orient. His Arabic was fluent and colloquial. "Those are sweet words," he shouted back. "Stand and let me thrust them down your throat." Within 200 yards, the gelding was pulled up. The Arab slipped off his back and turned to face Kurtz, flourishing the naval cutlass in his right hand. Kurtz realized he had no firearm. If he had carried a musket when he entered the camp, he had lost it somewhere along the way. He was dismounted and had only the cutlass and, of course, a dagger. An Arab always has a dagger. Kurtz had a great advantage, and no quixotic notions ever entered his calculations. He would exploit it to the full. He charged straight down on the Arab, leaning out to sabre him from horseback. The Arab was quicker than he anticipated. As soon as he read Kurtz's intention, he fainted away from the charge, and then at the last moment darted back under his sword arm, brushing down the flank of the running mare with the grace of a toreador leaning inside the horns of the charging bull. At the same time he reached up, grabbed a handful of the skirt of Kurtz's leather coat, and threw all his weight on it. It was so sudden and unexpected that Kurtz was taken by surprise. He was leaning far out from his mount's bare back, without stirrups or reins to steady himself, and he was hauled bodily off the mare. But Kurtz was a fighting man too, and like a cat he landed on his feet, with his grip on the hilt of his sabre. The Arab went for the forehand cut to the head again. Then immediately he reversed and cut low for the Achilles tendon. Kurtz met the first stroke, deflecting it with a twist of the wrist, but the second was so fast that he had to jump over the swing of the cutlass. He was in balance when he landed, and thrust straight at the Arab's dark, glittering eyes. The Arab rolled his head and let the stroke fly over his shoulder, but so close that it razored a tuft of his beard from below his ear. They sprang apart and circled each other. Neither was even breathing hard. Two warriors in peak condition. "What is your name, son of the false prophet?" Kurtz asked easily. "I like to know who I am killing." "My name is Kadam ibn Abu Bakr al-Jurf, infidel," he said softly, but his eyes glittered at the insult. "And, apart from eater of dung, what do men call you?" "I am Captain Herminius Kutz of the army of the VOC." "Ah," said Kadam, "your fame goes ahead of you. You are married to the pretty little whore named Nella, who has been fucked by every man who ever visited Good Hope. Even I had a few guilders' worth of her behind the hedge of the company gardens when I was in the colony only a short while ago. I commend you. She knows her trade and enjoys her work." The insult was so barbed and unexpected that Kurtz gaped at him. The Arab even knew her name. His sword arm faltered with the shock. On the instant, Kadam was at him again, and he had to scramble backwards to avoid the attack. They circled and came together, and this time Kurtz managed to touch high on his left shoulder. But it barely scratched the skin, and no more than a few scarlet drops showed through the thin, soiled cotton sleeve of Kadam's robe. They essayed a dozen more passes without a hit, and then Kadam scored, slicing open Kurtz's hip, but only skin deep. The blood made it look worse than it was. Nevertheless, Kurtz gave ground for the first time, and his sword arm ached. He regretted that wasted pistol shot. Kadam was smiling, a thin reptilian curl of the lips, and suddenly, as Kurtz had expected, a thin, curved dagger appeared in his left hand. Then Kadam came on again, very fast, leading with his right foot, his blade turning into a darting sunbeam, and Kurtz went back before it. His heel caught on a patch of thorns, and he nearly fell, but recovered with a sideways twist that jarred his spine. Kadam broke off again and circled out left. He had read Kurtz accurately. Left was his weak side. Kadam was not to know that years ago, during the fighting before Jaffna, he had taken a ball through that knee. It was aching now, and he was panting for breath. Kadam came on again, steely and relentless. By now Kurtz was flailing his blade a little, not thrusting straight and hard. His breath whistled in his own ears. He knew that it would not be much longer. The sweat burned his eyes, and Kadam's face blurred. Then, abruptly, Kadam pulled back and lowered his cutlass. He was staring over Kurtz's shoulder. It might have been a ruse, and Kurtz refused to respond. He watched the dagger in Kadam's left hand, trying to steady and compose himself for the next pass. Then he heard the sound of hoofs behind him. He turned slowly, and there were Odermann and Richter, mounted and fully armed, Clear leading them. Kadam let both the dagger and the cutlass drop from his hand, but still he stood with his chin lifted and his shoulders squared. "Shall I kill the swine pig, Captain?" Odermann asked as he rode up. His carbine was resting across the saddle in front of him. Kurtz almost gave the order. He was shaken and angry. He knew how close he had come, and Kadam had called Nella a whore. It was the truth, but death to any man who uttered it in Kurtz's hearing. Then he checked himself. The man had spoken of good hope. There was something to learn from that, and later Kurtz would kill him with his own hands. That would give him more pleasure than letting Odermann do it for him. "I want to hear more from him. Tie him behind your horse." It was almost 2 leagues back to camp. They bound Kadam's wrists together and tied the other end of the rope to the snap ring on the wing of Odermann's saddle. He dragged Kadam at a trot. When he fell, Odermann jerked him to his feet again, but each time Kadam lost a piece of skin from where his elbows or his knees struck the hard ground. He was coated with a paste of dust, sweat and blood when Odermann dragged him into the camp. Kurtz swung down from the back of the grey mare and went to inspect the other 3 Arab prisoners that Odermann had captured. "Names?" he demanded of the 2 who seemed uninjured. "Rashud, Effendi. Khaban, Effendi." They touched their foreheads and breasts in respect and submission. He went to the 3rd prisoner, who was wounded. He lay groaning, curled like a fetus in the womb. "Name?" Kurtz said, and kicked him in the belly. The wounded man groaned louder, and fresh blood trickled from between his fingers where he was clutching his stomach. Kurtz glanced at Odermann. "Stupid Hoffel," Odermann explained. "He was carried away with excitement, forgot your orders and shot him. It's in the belly. He won't live until tomorrow." "So, better this than one of the horses," Kurtz said, and drew the pistol from the holster on his sword belt. He cocked it and held the muzzle to the back of the wounded man's head. At the shot, the prisoner stiffened, his eyes rolled back in their sockets, his legs kicked spasmodically, then lay still. "Waste of good gunpowder," said Odermann. "Should have let me use the knife." "I haven't had my breakfast yet, and you know how squeamish I can be." Kurtz smiled at his own sense of humour and returned the smoking pistol to its holster. He waved his hand towards the other prisoners. "Give them each 10 with the shambok across the soles of both feet to put them in a friendlier mood, and as soon as I have finished my breakfast I will speak to them again." Kurtz ate a bowl of stew made from the shanks of the hartebeest, and watched Odermann and Richter lay on the shambok to the bare feet of the Arab captives. "Hard men," Kurtz gave grudging approval, when the only sound they made was a small grunt to the fall of each stroke. He knew what agony they were enduring. Kurtz wiped out the bowl with a finger and sucked it as he went back to squat in front of Kadam. Despite his torn and dusty robe, the cuts and abrasions that covered his limbs, Kadam was so obviously the leader that Kurtz wasted no time on the others. He glanced up at Odermann and indicated Rashud and Khaban. "Take these pig swine away." Odermann knew that he wanted them out of earshot while he questioned Kadam so that they would not hear his replies. Later he would question them separately and compare their responses. Kurtz waited until the Hottentot troopers had dragged them, limping on their swollen feet, to a tree and tied them to its trunk. Then he turned back to Kadam.
So, you visited the Cape of Good Hope, beloved of Allah.
Kadam stared back at him with fanatical, glittering eyes in his dusty face.
However, the mention of the place stirred something in Odoman's sluggish mind. He fetched one of the muskets they had captured from the Arabs and handed it to his captain.
Kurtz's first glance at the weapon was perfunctory.
"The buttstock," Odoman directed his attention. "See the emblem in the wood?"
Kurtz's eyes narrowed and his lips formed a thin, hard line as he traced the design that had been burned into the wood with a branding iron. It depicted a cannon, a long-barreled 9-pounder on a 2-wheeled carriage, and in the ribbon below it the initials CBTC.
"Good, so," Kurtz looked up and stared at Kadam. "You are one of Tom and Dorian Courtney's men."
Kurtz saw something flare in the depths of those dark eyes, but it was so swiftly hidden again that he could not be certain of it. But the emotion the names had engendered was passionate. It might have been loyalty, dedication, or something different.
Kurtz sat and stared at him.
"You know my wife," Kurtz reminded him, "and I might have to castrate you for the way you spoke of her. But do you know the Courtney brothers, Tom and Dorian? If you do, it might just save your balls."
Kadam stared back at him, and Kurtz spoke to Odoman.
"Sergeant, lift his skirts that we can judge how big is the knife that we must use for the job."
Odoman grinned and knelt beside Kadam, but before he could touch him, Kadam spoke.
"I know Dorian Courtney, but his Arabic name is Al-Salil." "The red-headed one," Kurtz agreed.
"Yes, I have heard him called that. What of his brother, Tom, the one who men also called Klebi, the hawk?"
"I know them both," Kadam affirmed. "You are their hireling, their creature, their lackey, their lickspittle?"
Kurtz chose his words with care to provoke him.
"I am their implacable enemy," Kadam rushed into the trap, his pride bristling. "If Allah is kind, then one day I will be their executioner."
He said it with such fierce sincerity that Kurtz believed him. He said nothing, for often silence is the best form of interrogation.
Kadam was by now so agitated that he burst out,
"I am the bearer of the sacred fatwa, entrusted to me by my master, the ruler of Oman, Caliph Zayn al-Din ibn al-Malik."
"Why would such a noble and mighty monarch entrust such a mission to a miserable slice of rancid pork fat such as you?"
Kurtz gave a mocking laugh. Although Odoman had not understood a word of the Arabic exchanges, he laughed like an echo.
"I am a prince of the royal blood," Kadam avowed angrily. "My father was the Caliph's brother. I am his nephew. The Caliph trusts me because I command his legions, and I have proven myself to him 100 times over in war and in peace."
"Yet you have failed to accomplish this sacred fatwa of yours," Kurtz taunted him. "Your enemies still flourish, and you are in rags, tied to a tree and covered with filth. Is that the Omani ideal of a mighty warrior?"
"I have slain the incestuous sister of the Caliph, which was part of the task I was given, and I have stabbed Al-Salil so deeply and grievously that he might still perish of the wound. If he does not, I will not rest until my duty is accomplished."
"All this is the raving of a madman," Kurtz smirked at him. "If you are driven by the sacred duty, why do I find you wandering like a beggar in the wilderness, dressed in filthy rags, carrying a musket with Al-Salil's emblem branded on it, trying to steal a horse on which to escape?"
Skillfully, Kurtz milked the information out of his captive.
Kadam boasted of how he had inveigled himself on board the gift of Allah, how he had waited his opportunity, and how he had struck. He described his assassination of the Princess Yasmini, and how he had come so close to killing Al-Salil also. Then he described how, with the help of his 3 followers, he had escaped from the Courtney ship while it lay in the lagoon, how they had avoided the pursuit, and at last had stumbled on Kurtz's troop. There was much in this account that was entirely new to Kurtz, especially the flight of the Courtneys from the colony of Good Hope. This must have taken place long after he had left in pursuit of Jim Courtney. However, all of it was logical, and he could detect no weak spots in the story nor any attempt to deceive him in Kadem's rendition of it. Everything seemed to fit neatly into what he knew of Kesa and his intentions.
It was also the kind of resourceful enterprise that Tom and Dorian Courtney between them might devise. He believed it, with reservations. There were always reservations.
Yes, he gloated inwardly, without letting it show in his expression. This is an extraordinary stroke of fortune, he thought. I have been sent an ally I can bind to me by chains of steel, a religious fatwa, and a burning hatred beside which even my own determination pales.
Kurtz stared hard at Cadum while he made his decision. He had lived among the Musselmen, fought for and against them long enough to understand the teachings of Islam and the immutable codes of honour that bound them. "I also am the sworn enemy of de Courtenay's," he said at last. He saw the naked passion in Cadum's eyes veiled immediately.
"Have I made a fatal mistake?" he wondered. "Have I rushed too swiftly to my purpose and startled my quarry?"
He watched Cadum's suspicion growing stronger.
"However, I have taken the plunge now, and I cannot go back."
Kurtz turned to Odoman. "Loosen his bonds," he ordered, "and bring water for him to wash and drink. Give him food to eat and let him pray. But watch him carefully. I don't think he will try to escape, but do not give him the chance."
Odoman looked mystified by these orders. "What about his men?" he asked uncertainly.
"Keep them tied up and under close guard," Kurtz told him. "Don't let Cadum speak to them. Don't let him go near them." Kurtz waited until after Cadum had bathed, eaten, and carried out the solemn ritual of the midday prayers. Only then did he send for him to continue their conversation. Kurtz observed the polite form of greeting, and in so doing changed Cadum's status from that of captive to guest, with all the responsibilities that that relationship placed on both of them. Then he went on. "The reason why you find me here in the wilderness, so far from the civilized abodes of men, is that I am following the same quest as you. Behold these wagon tracks." He pointed them out, and Cadum glanced at them. Of course, he had noticed them while he had stalked the horses and closed in on the camp. "Do you see them?" Kurtz insisted. Cadum's face set in a stony expression. He was already regretting his previous indiscretions. He should never have let his emotions run away with his tongue and revealed so much to the infidel. By now he had recognized that Kurtz was a clever, dangerous man. "These treks were made by four wagons that are being driven by the only son of Tom Courtney, whom you know as Clebby." Cadum blinked but showed no other expression. Kurtz let him think about that for a while. Then he explained why Jim Courtney had been forced to leave the colony. Although Cadum listened in silence and his eyes showed no more emotion than those of a cobra, he was thinking furiously. While he had been masquerading as a lowly seaman aboard the Gift of Allah, he had heard all this discussed by his companions. He knew about Jim Courtney's flight from Good Hope. "If we follow these wagon tracks, we can be certain that they will lead us to the place somewhere on the coast where father and son have agreed to meet," Kurtz finished. And again they were silent. Cadum thought about what Kurtz had told him. He turned it over and back and forth in his mind, the way a jeweller examines a precious stone for impurities. He could detect no false notes in Kurtz's version of events.
"What do you want of me?" he asked at last.
"We share the same purpose," Kurtz answered. "I propose a pact, an alliance. Let us take the oath together in the sight of God and his prophet. Let us dedicate ourselves to the total destruction of our mutual enemies."
"I agree to that," said Cadum.
And the mad glitter he had so carefully masked returned to his eyes. Kurtz found it unsettling, more menacing than the cutlass and dagger in the Arab's hands when they had fought that morning. They took the oath beneath the towering branches of a camel-thorn tree, in which new growth had already burgeoned to replace that which had been devoured by the locust swarms. They swore on the blade and the haft of Cadum's Damascus steel dagger. Each placed a pinch of coarse salt on the other's tongue. They shared a slice of venison, swallowing a morsel each. With the razor-sharp Damascus blade, they opened a vein in their right wrists, then massaged the arm until the blood was flowing bright and warm down into their cupped palms. Then they clasped hands so that their blood mingled and maintained the grip while Kadem recited the wondrous names of God. At last they embraced.
"You are my brother in blood," said Kadem, and his voice trembled in awe at the binding power of the oath.
"You are my brother in blood," Kurtz said, though his voice was firm and clear, and his gaze into Kadem's eyes was steady, the oath sat lightly upon his conscience. Kurtz recognized no god, especially not the foreign deity of a dark-skinned inferior race. The profit in the bargain was all his, for he could turn away from it when the time came, even kill his new blood brother with impunity if it were called for. He knew that Kadem was bound by his hope of salvation and the wrath of his god. Deep in his heart, Kadem recognized the fragility of the bond between them. That evening, as they shared the campfire and ate meat together, he showed how astute he was. He gave Kurtz an undertaking more poignant than any religious oath.
"I have told you that I am the favourite of my uncle, the Caliph. You know also the power and riches of the Omani Empire. Its realm encompasses a great ocean, and the Red and Persian seas. My uncle has promised me great reward if I carry his fatwa to a successful conclusion. You and I have sworn, as brothers in blood, to dedicate ourselves to that end. Once it is done, we will return together to the Caliph's palace on Lamu Island, and to his gratitude. You will embrace Islam. I will request my uncle to place you in command of all his armies on the African mainland. I will ask him to make you governor of the provinces of Monomotapa, the land from which come the gold and slaves of Opet. You will become a man of power and wealth unaccountable."
The spring tides of Herminius Kurtz's life were beginning to flow strongly.